Kia ora and welcome back to another episode of Build Aotearoa. I'm the host of the show, Matthew Cutler-Walsh, and it's great to have you with me this week. Sorry I missed an episode last week. I had a little bit of time with my parents, which was very nice to see them travelling again. But there's lots going on. I have been watching, listening, trying to figure out what's happening in the building industry. There's a few things that seem to be common themes at the moment. One, of course, is the ongoing issue of cost of living, which seems to be a talking point across media and just in the general population. When I hear about that, it reminds me of conversations about housing affordability that they're often talked about in the same context. And cost of living, you know, it is a real issue, and housing affordability is also a real issue. I am, with regards to housing affordability, I often talk about the issue of being able to own and operate in a house ongoing, or rent and operate a house ongoing, which often gets conflated with the issue of the price of building a house. And we get into these arguments about we can't possibly add more to homes and make them better, make them more energy efficient, because houses are so expensive. So how can we contemplate adding more to them? And a counter to that is that, yeah, houses are expensive, but it's not the bits necessarily that make them efficient and healthy that are going to make them expensive. It's just the fact that you need to build a house is the expensive part. Whether it's efficient, well-designed, you still need a chunk of heavy material, whether it's concrete, steel, you need a bunch of timber, you need plasterboard, you need windows, you need some sort of roof material. All those things have got to be there, and they're expensive, particularly when you have to pay someone to put them there and put them in the right place. But putting them in the right place is the critical part, and that's where good design comes in. Good designers are there, if they're doing their job, to figure out what materials you should use, how much of those materials, and where to put things in relation to each other and how to connect them to each other. So that's the value of good design. That's the value of things like energy modeling and integrative design, compact design, so that you can have a good outcome regardless of budget and think of the end in mind. The other thing that is being talked about a lot at the moment is the issue of fast tracking, and this has come up with this current government. There's a lot of talk about getting things moving, and that can go both ways. That can open up industry, get things happening in all sorts of sectors. But there's a counter to that. Sometimes it's good to take a little bit of time to consider the wider implications, particularly environmental consequences, when we're talking about opening up tracts of land for building or mining or building roads and infrastructure. So there is a balance there. Yes, we don't want to delay things unnecessarily and have red tape, or as I've heard this term in the last couple of weeks, I heard the term green tape, which worries me, because that implies that concerns over environmental impacts are unwarranted because they're holding up a project. Well, sometimes it's good to hold up a project if the consequences, the environmental consequences of that project, may be irreversible or not be able to be mitigated appropriately. So it's good to get things done, but it's also not a good idea to rush headlong into things when the motivation for getting things done is either just to check off items off a checklist or for the sake of economic growth at the expense of everything else. I don't know what the solution to all that is, because clearly there were some issues with the RMA, the Resource Management Act that New Zealand had, but also we need to acknowledge that the Resource Management Act was considered quite it was considered quite highly around the world, and we often have pieces of legislation that are quite leading not perfect by any means. They're still problematic, but people do look at us and some of the things we do and admire what we've done. Not everything by all means. So that's something to figure out. In terms of the building sector, though, a lot of the talk around fast tracking seems to be around infrastructure right now, which is related to building because it's things like roads and pipes. But it's the focus seems to be more on larger scale infrastructure at this stage. We're still yet to see what the implications might be, although there's plenty of hinting towards opening up more or making it easier for councils to open up more green fields for urban development. We possibly need a little bit of that, but it does concern me that we end up having more urban sprawl, particularly as there has also already been there is going to be less of a requirement for councils to have to consider densification in their urban planning, so that is a signal that there's going to be a rebalancing or more of a push towards opening up new land on the fringes rather than the previous emphasis on building up. A couple of other issues. Build to rent continues to be a talking point, particularly around how tax incentives and financial levers can help promote buildings purposely for the rental market. That's really important because the other thing that has popped up this week again is the changes or the reverting back to the possibility to turf out tenants more easily from landlords. And that I'm not going to get into that issue, but I think the great benefit of build to rent is that it shifts the culture of renting and provides the opportunity for people to have long-term tenure, which is, if you dig into it, really what a lot of people want. We have this assumption that people want to get on the ladder, so to speak, and there are financial reasons for doing that and tax reasons in New Zealand. But for a lot of people who aren't necessarily interested in that, at least not immediately, they just want security for themselves and their family, and build to rent can offer that. The prospect of having a rental agreement that is years long and that's fixed is an absolute game changer for someone who would otherwise be nervous every 90 days they might get turfed out. So lots going on, and I should also mention over on the Passive House podcast, which I co-host with Zach Simke and the team from the Passive House Accelerator, Ilka, Mary, Zach himself, and a few others were in Innsbruck at the Passive House Conference, the International Passive House Conference recently, and there are some bonus episodes of that podcast that Mary and Ilka did while they were there, so check those out. And we're also back to our regular episodes on the Passive House podcast. So definitely check that out if you're interested in Passive House. All right. Well, let's get into this week's feature interview. This was a conversation that I recorded a little while ago now with Steve Penny. And it was a bit of a response to Steve actually reaching out to me to feature on his own podcast called A Penny for Your Thoughts, where he was doing a series on sustainability, and myself and I was very honoured to be amongst other people like Susan Crumdike and my colleague Sam Archer and a few others that Steve interviewed on his own show. So you can check that out wherever you get your podcasts. But here is my chat with Steve Penny. All right. Well, today I've got with me Steve Penny, a fellow podcaster. How are you, Steve?
I'm good, thank you. Yes, yeah. And
you're based in Christchurch.
That's correct. Yep.
How are things down there?
I think, well, yeah, from a work perspective, there's certainly been a bit of a slowdown, as it is. I think the change of government and a few other things have kind of slowed a few projects down. But, you know, weather-wise, the sun's shining today. I'll be going out, taking the dogs for a walk after we finish here. And, you know, we've got family dinner tonight, so I've got a nice weekend ahead of me. I'm quite looking forward to it, to be honest.
Very good. All right. Well, let's kick off. First of all, I'd like to find out from people, have you got a favorite building?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this one. It's actually one that I worked on a project right at the start of my sort of sustainability journey. I'm working for a company called Atelier 10, and we were involved with the design of a project called the Kimberlin Library, which is at De Montfort University in Leicester in the UK. And the Kimberlin Library building was a new extension to their existing library, and it was built using hollow-core slabs. So it was a three-story building, as I recall, and it was about 2,000 square meters per floor. So it's quite a large building, but it was built on the basis that it was going to be extremely low energy. So the it was very massive structure, like very thick external facades, triple glazed windows, and this hollow core slab was used as a thermal store. So we used a system that was called Thermodec, which is basically blowing air through the hollow cores and out into the space. It was a full fresh air system with heat recovery on the ventilation side of things, and that we ended up putting in radiators because we didn't trust our design that we wouldn't need the radiators, but the radiators were never turned on. So the heating in that building was all done through the air system, which is a very low air volume. I think the boiler capacity for that building, for you know, 5 or 6,000 square meter building, was about 80 kilowatts. So it's extremely low energy and stable conditions inside. So it was very, very comfortable. And you know, it was opened my eyes to what you can do if you design a good building. It wasn't a big concrete box. It sounds like it should have been, but it was a lot of glazing. But because it was triple glazed and you know, well thermally insulated, it was actually quite a light building. And with exposed concrete soffit, it didn't feel like it was too closed in. It was quite a tall space. So you know, from an architectural perspective, it worked really well. From a heating and power perspective, it worked really well. And from an occupancy perspective, it was, you know, very, very comfortable.
And when was it?
So it
When
was
was
one
this? How long ago?
that would have been 98, I think, roundabout.
Right.
So quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah. Well, I get that leads on to you. How do you feel when you see in all that intervening time, buildings that could perform like that but don't?
disappointed. Probably is the strongest feeling, but also a bit frustration. I think, you know, I'm a building services engineer. My role is to design the systems that go inside the building, but we also, you know, as an industry, building services is responsible for most of the energy use in buildings. You know, we do all the design for the lighting, the heating, the power, and everything else, which is where all the energy is. So we, you know, we have a responsibility to let people know whether what they're doing is impacting on the energy use in the building. And I think we tend to stick to our lane too much, and we don't get involved with conversations around the building facade, building orientation, thermal insulation as much as we should, because all of those factors impact on what we do as engineers.
That would
And I
reduce
think,
your work, wouldn't it?
no,
Right.
I don't see that it would. I mean, what it does is, I suppose you could say it does. It means that we need less heating and less lighting and less power if we design the building better. But you know, my view has always been that buildings are they're a system, a complete system. You can't treat them as individual parts. And if you do treat them as individual parts, you get very inefficient buildings. You know, the when I was working with Atelier 10, you know, fairly early in my career, it's probably my third job out of study. It opened my eyes to the fact that we, you know, we need to be part of a team that's delivering a building, not the services engineers that are delivering the services to a building. Because you know, if you design it with your eyes open to the rest of the team, you can actually end up with a much better solution for everybody. Like that Kimberlin Library building that I said is one of my favorite buildings, that was designed with the structural engineers and the architects and us as a complete unit, delivering a building rather than delivering the bits of the building. And because of that, we ended up with an excellent outcome. And I think,
Do you recall what it was that allowed for that to happen? Because we talk about that integrated design approach quite a lot these days,
yeah,
but it what
it's
allow what makes
relationships,
that
I
happen?
think. The guy that was leading Atelier 10, still, he does lead Atelier 10, is a guy called Patrick Bellew, and he's built a really good reputation around sustainable design. And his reputation allows him to have conversations that sometimes it's hard to have about how the building is going to be designed, and actually has a real influence over the design of the physical building itself. But also at the time, there was a real drive in the UK for building better buildings. The building code had been updated to improve energy efficiency, and you know, it was part of the whole drive at the time to get better efficiency out of our buildings. So it was a good time to do it as well, you know, kind of cutting edge piece of design. And Atelier 10 were building a reputation for doing that kind of work across the UK. So there was a whole load of things that came in together at the same time. But, you know, that's something that they've continued on. They're now one of the best known sustainability consultants and low energy consultants in the world. So, you know, it's certainly something that they've capitalized on, I would say.
And I should direct people to a previous conversation that you had interviewing Patrick from
yes,
August
absolutely.
2023 on your own show. Why did you start your own podcast?
Why did I start my own podcast? Actually, primarily because I was looking for a hobby to do. I run my own business, which kind of can easily take up all of your time. And I was very aware of the fact that I didn't really have a lot that I did outside of the business. And I was looking for something to do. And you know, about 2 years ago, I was listening to a lot of podcasts that were spoken word rather than music and sort of entertainment type things. People interviewing one another and chatting about different aspects of what was going on in their lives. And I liked that format. And I kind of just made the decision to try it and see what happened.
Yep. And, nice. and you've had
episodes later.
A great series. There's some really, really great people. Some people that are familiar to me, particularly most recently, Professor Susan Crumdyke. I actually had the pleasure of being a student when she was teaching at University of Canterbury. Pretty amazing thinker. And I think ahead of her time in terms of, she was talking about
very
transition
so.
Engineering back then. It was 20 years ago and even before then.
And it's still not really a common term now.
No, it's not. It describes so well what I think we need to be doing.
Absolutely. We're the way she was speaking to me on the podcast about the idea that it's dictated to us that we buy buildings and we do this and we do that because of the society we're in. And a lot of that dictates how we use energy and how we live our lives. We need to change that because that is creating a situation where we're inefficient in what we do. It's that sort of fundamental shift in what we see as the key values for how we live our lives. You know, it's quite hard to do. It needs a lot of political will, and I'd be surprised if there's many countries where that political will exists.
Well, where do you see things at the moment? Here in New Zealand, let's focus in on the building industry. What are the most significant challenges and opportunities as you see them?
I think the biggest challenge we face is a reluctance to change. That if you look at the construction industry, that there's a real reluctance within most organisations to change the way we do things. The good example of that is the change of the building code recently that took way too long to implement, that people were pushing back against increasing or changing the glazing to thermally broken double glazed units and upgrading the building R values was really, there was so much pushback on it from people saying, it's going to change the way we build buildings. We don't know how to do it. It's going to be really much harder. It's going to be a lot more expensive. That pushback is a real issue for us if we're going to hit our targets around 2050, and it is a reluctance to change things. But we have to change things. We're in a situation where every year we've got issues where there's fires raging across the country, there's floods everywhere, there's earthquakes and other things that's all going on, and we're not dealing with those events at all well. You know, we've and I'm not talking about just New Zealand, I'm talking about globally. You look at what's happening in Australia. They've had one in 100 year fires and one in 100 year floods every other year for the last few years. So the climate change is a real thing, and we're not taking it very seriously, I don't think. I think we're approaching it as if it's a nice to have to reduce our carbon, not an absolutely essential way for us to continue living on this planet, which in my view it is.
How do we reconcile those issues with the urgency and the demand just for housing and the issue of unaffordability?
That is a big challenge. I think that it's housing is a real problem around the world, in that there's a lot of low quality housing already built, and the issue we have with that low quality housing, and I think this is something that doesn't really get talked about enough, is that the health impact of a poor quality house is significant, and the cost of that health impact is also very significant. And if we just approach, again, it's this holistic view thing, if we just approach building the houses as being, it's the cost of the house, it isn't. It's the cost of the other aspects that go around building that house. So if you build a house that is good for people to live in, it's low energy, so it doesn't cost a lot to run, it's sustainable in the way that it's built, so it doesn't have a big impact on the environment, and also it keeps the people in the building healthy, then there's a lot of additional savings that you get that you don't get if you build a cheap shit house. And we don't talk enough about the other aspects of it. I think we just focus on how expensive it is to build a house and not how expensive it is to build a bad house.
How do we make the people that profit from building and selling that house realize some of that cost? Because those costs aren't borne out at the moment by the real estate sector or the building sector. They're borne out by us as taxpayers, ultimately.
Yeah. I don't know the answer. I really don't know the answer to that question, but I think that's a subject that needs to be discussed more. Uh-huh. That, you know, that there is a real cost to building poor housing, and that real cost is much greater than the cost of building better housing. And how we get that balance in the economy, I don't know. I'm not an economist, but there will be a way of doing it. You're looking at reducing the amount of spend on healthcare so you can increase the amount of spend on social housing, maybe. Yeah. There'll be a balance somewhere. It's understanding that data. There's enough data around to show the impact, on an individual basis. I know that my youngest daughter, we lived in a house in Wellington that's very damp and moldy. She developed asthma at the age of about 8, and she's still got asthma now, and she's 21 this year. And that is because of the house. That's an ongoing health issue. That's an ongoing cost to her and also an ongoing cost to the health service. So that's one person times that by 4 million people. There's a lot of cost potentially there if people are living in bad houses, and that money has to come from us as taxpayers. That's how the National Health works. So if we can reduce that cost, that money that we're already giving to the government can be spent elsewhere, would be my simplistic view.
We've seen a whole raft of changes just recently with new government, one of which has been talked just this week as a recording of fast-tracking of consenting. I think a lot of the conversation at this stage is around infrastructure and larger projects, but it may have an impact on where we can build and what type of building we can do. Any thoughts on any of those changes?
One of the things that I heard recently, I had a breakfast with some people earlier on, last week actually, and they were talking about changes to resource consents where rural consents are being changed so that you can't build anything other than farmland on rural land. So the idea, I think, is to stop farmers selling off their land to become housing. But what it's also stopping is building stockyards and building storage barns for feed and other things, because it's not been well drafted, I guess. But I think that what that's doing is going to be putting pressure on more housing in cities, and towns and other areas. So you're going to end up seeing a much, probably, I think the drive behind it is probably to get more high density housing developments,
mm-hmm.
that you go away from spreading out onto big pieces of farmland to focusing on around the edges of existing conurbations.
Yeah.
And I think that is a good thing. I think, you know, for all the studies that exist, high density housing is the most efficient way to build housing. But, you know, we need to, the other issue I've seen in the past in other countries, like I've worked in Dubai for a little while, Dubai was very good at building things fast, but it built them in the wrong order. So it built all the housing and then realized it needed roads and power supplies and drainage after all the housing was built, and then have to go in and put all of that infrastructure in afterwards. So I think there's the idea should be that we look at where we want to get more people. We build the infrastructure out to cope with that additional occupation. And then we start looking at what type of developments we put around that area as well. And I think the focus needs to be on high density housing. It needs, and we also need to consider what we do with transport, because New Zealand is terrible at transport.
Yeah.
And part of the driver for that, I think, is the size of the population, that we're too small a country to have mass transit systems that work efficiently. But I think it's almost a build it and they will come type thing. If you build a good mass transit system, people will use it. Mm-hmm. The reason people don't use it at the moment is because it's not very good.
Yeah.
It's easier to get in your car and get anywhere.
Yeah, so it's a bit chicken and egg.
It is, yeah. And it's, you know, I think the other issue that New Zealand needs to face up to is we need to be bigger. We need more people. We actually need to grow the population in this country to have an economy of a scale that can do things like mass transit and make it work.
Yeah.
And that, I think there's a big reluctance to grow the population. We don't want lots of other people coming in. We like the fact we've got this little country all to ourselves, but, you know, it's massively underpopulated. We could do with more people, because we could be a lot more efficient if we had more people.
It's interesting you bring up Dubai. So you've worked there, but you've also experienced living in places like the UK and you know, your way around Europe. Do you think there are important lessons there from how they've done density?
The biggest example, I guess, is London. You look at the way London works as a commuter town, a commuter city rather. You know, there's a massive amount of commuting in and out of London every single day. It's about 7 or 8 million people a day, I think, that commute in and out of London. So it's almost double the population of New Zealand that move in and out of London. And the way they've dealt with housing is they've got to saturation point effectively in London itself. It's difficult to find spaces to build accommodation in London because it's so spread out and so densely populated. So now you've got a commuter belt around the outside of London, which is new towns that have been built post-war to take all of the people moving out of London, and it's given those people the ability to buy a reasonable house that's, you know, in a nicer area, and allowing them to still work in London, where the majority of the work is in the southeast. So that sort of model works quite well. And you've got, you know, people in the UK, and I was one of them, used to complain all the time about the mass transit, the trains and the buses and everything else. But the reality is, it's a bloody good system. You know, it transports a massive number of people every day. And yeah, it breaks down every now and again, but the level of usage it gets, I'm not surprised. You know, it's doing a huge job, and it does it very, very well. So I think that's the scale thing, though. You need that scale to make that type of system work.
Yeah.
In New Zealand, we've got to focus more on probably electric buses rather than on trains.
Yeah.
And get that network working well. And, you know, you could look at train networks around the North Island, maybe between the main centres. The tracks are already there, but the service isn't. And that maybe needs some investment to allow you to travel into Auckland from further away more efficiently. And those kind of things. So those are the sort of bigger picture things that I think we need to be focusing on. But, you know, the starting point is, where does the money come from? And with the economy the size it is, it's difficult to fund those kind of investments.
Interesting. You mentioned electric buses. There's a lot of talk about electrification of buildings as well. How you feel about that in terms of mechanical services in your area of weaning ourselves off things like gas?
One of the projects we're doing at the moment for Lincoln University is actually getting rid of their coal-fired boilers, because they're currently heated with steam generated from coal-fired boilers. So for the, since 2021, we've been working with Lincoln to get rid of the boilers. So we're replacing the heating source with electric heating. And it's either air source heat pumps or VRV refrigerant-based systems, or it's electric boilers. We've got sort of three different systems that we're using. And the big impact to that, obviously, is that there's a much greater electrical load on the campus. So we're having to upgrade all of the electrical infrastructure to deal with the additional load. But, you know, it's part of the, they're also looking at growing or developing, rather, a solar farm on an adjacent piece of land, which will allow them to generate, I think it's a 1.5 megawatt farm. So generate 1.5 megawatts at peak that they sell back to the grid during the summer, and then they use that in the winter for their heating.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting that, I mean, that's a large entity. It's got quite a high demand just as itself, having to upgrade their infrastructure. But that probably is reflective of the national grid. Do you think the grid, are we set up for a mass transition to electrification?
No, we're not. No, there's already strains on the network, as we know. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about is that other countries in the world are starting to legislate now that every new house has solar panels on the roof. I think we should be doing the same. I think every building that's built should have solar panels on the roof, which won't deal with the overall load, but it will help to soften the peaks a little bit. And I think that sort of approach of saying, when you're putting a new building up, make sure you've got an element of PV on the roof, or even consider replacing the roof with a PV system, because that exists as a as an option as well. And then you start to take some of the building load off of the grid and help that ease that load. But the other thing you've got to look at is all of the existing buildings that we've got that are still got tungsten halogen lamps in them. There's massive savings in energy that can be made just by swapping them out for LEDs. And that sort of stuff has all got to be done every time you're looking at refurbishing a building, for example, whether it's a house or an office or a warehouse. Take out the existing lighting, put in new low energy lighting. Because what we're seeing is that you're adding load into the building with the heat pumps, but if you can take some of that load out by changing the other systems in the building, then the impact, overall impact on the grid, the net impact is reduced. And that sort of thing is what we've got to start doing everywhere.
That seems like such low-hanging fruit, changing light bulbs. I kind of assume the bulk of that work had already been done, but it's scary to think that there's still a bunch of halogen, probably some incandescent bulbs out there.
There are quite a few. Yes. Yeah. I mean, certainly in housing, I think a lot of the existing housing stock is all still incandescent fittings and... Yeah, it is low hanging fruit, as you say. But you know, where's the motivation to do it? Why would that household go out and spend $15 on a light fitting?
Yeah,
like, beyond there's no that motivation.
Beyond that low hanging fruit, and what is some of the work that you're involved in on a daily basis now at with your own company, and where do you see the next big benefits to improving our existing stock?
Well, I think as we were talking about right at the start, it's this changing our approach to designing buildings away from being siloed into our own particular part and looking at the building as a holistic, complete system. And that's where you're going to get the big efficiency gains. And we are talking really about making big efficiency gains across every sector, not just housing, but also commercial and industrial. If you want to do that, you need to consider the building as a whole and make sure that everything that you put into that building is as efficient as it can be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the focus needs to be. I don't think that's where the focus is, though. I think at the moment we're still way too focused on what's the first cost of that building and how can we make it cheaper.
Yeah.
And that attitude needs to change, whether it's a house or an office or a warehouse, it needs to change.
Do you offer services for doing that type of thing for both new builds and existing buildings?
Yes, we do. Yep.
Where can people find a bit more about what you do and get in touch?
Well, our website's got a lot of information on it about what we can do. We do audits of existing installed systems, so we can give you a report that tells you where you're spending a lot of money in terms of energy or where you're spending a lot of money in terms of maintenance, and look at how you can change those things to get a better, more efficient system. But we, you know, do new build designs, we do refurbishments of existing buildings. It's all on our website.
And you, do you work mostly in the commercial industrial space?
No, actually, most of our work is tertiary education right now. Right. We've done some housing, work. We've done a bit of work with Kangiora in the past, but we're focusing at the moment on tertiary education and healthcare as our sort of key sectors. Primarily because there's clients that are a bit more focused on the long term, less focused on the first cost, because they own and occupy the buildings that we're working in. So they understand the benefits of that more whole of life look at the cost of a building. So that's where we like to focus, but we have done a fair few commercial and industrial type developments as well. And we're just working on a couple of warehouses for Christchurch City Council for their parks department. So you know, we're kind of doing different things.
Just before we finish up, you mentioned H1 changes have happened, gone through. Where should the next change be for the building code?
I mean, I still don't think it went far enough, if I'm honest. I think that H1 needs to go, you know, we need to be looking at much better performing buildings, whether it's commercial or residential or industrial. And that needs to carry on. We need to push through higher, and we need to sort of start looking more globally as well. We need to start looking at our infrastructure network and how we deliver the energy. You know, we've got a bit of a I don't know, rose-tinted spectacles about how energy efficient New Zealand is, because and how green it is, because we've got a lot of hydroelectric and wind power. But the way we use that energy is pretty profligate at the moment. We need to change how we use it as much as how we generate it. And there's still a lot of work to do in that space, in my view.
Yeah. Awesome. Hey, well, thank you very much, Steve. Really good to catch
You're
up.
You're very
and
welcome.
I will put some links in there to both your company, but also your podcast, because you've had some great guests on there,
much.
And I think people would find that very valuable. So
Thanks,
keep up the good work.
Good to talk to you. Thank you. I'll speak to you soon.
And that was Steve Penny. You can check out Steve's own show, Penny for Your Thoughts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for listening in. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, and hopefully we'll see you again soon here on Build Aotearoa.